What I'd like to do today is to try to shed some light on the political and policy dimensions of EPA's upcoming power plant rulemakings under the Clean Air Act, drawing on my experience in the trenches over the last four plus years, and trying to offer some predictions and judgments about the road that EPA is traveling, that the administration is traveling, and where that road is going to lead. So the first thing that I wanted to emphasize is that the president's June Climate Action Plan, which directs EPA to reduce greenhouse gas emissions from new and existing plants, and sets a demanding schedule, really is a mandate from the president to EPA. It is about as clear a set of directions that an executive branch agency could get from the White House, and it really puts the credibility and the prestige of the White House squarely behind EPA regulation of greenhouse gas emissions. This is a real change from the world we lived in before the presidential election. Jeff Homestead said this morning that EPA is simply doing what they said they were going to do at a settlement agreement a couple of years ago. But while that may be true, what is really new here is the explicit support of the White House, and the president, I think, was quite equivocal during the first term on climate change, and for that reason, EPA really did not know how far they can go. And now I think it's pretty clear this is EPA's top priority for the second term, and they're going to pull all the stops out to get the job done. That doesn't mean, of course, that the path forward is going to be easy. Anybody who listened to Jeff Homestead this morning undoubtedly got the impression that there are some very knotty legal issues, and a lot of folks in the regulated community and their counsel who are chafing at the bit to raise those issues. And so the agency does have a very challenging path ahead. Whether the agency can be successful in doing what I think is about the biggest thing that EPA has ever done in its long history is an open question, but I am certainly in the optimistic camp, and I will try to explain some of the reasons why that's the case. Before we turn to the plant itself, I think it's useful to do a retrospective on climate change policy over the last 20 years. This is not a pretty story. It's a fairly tortured story of false starts, of high hopes that turned out to be unrealistic, of poisonous scientific debate and political gridlock. But it's also a story of surprising judicial activism in the form of the Mass v. EPA decision, which I think is the one bright spot in the landscape that has actually opened the door for EPA to do what it's doing today. The slide lays out just a very high-level chronology of key milestones. And, of course, the first milestone is the 1992 Framework Convention on Climate Change. And the old-timers among us will remember that President Bush, the first President Bush, got dragged kicking and screaming to Rio de Janeiro, maneuvering right up until the last minute to avoid going there and signing the Framework Convention. He did it in the end, but he did it very, very reluctantly. Then when President Clinton came into office, he, like President Obama, announced a climate change action plan, but it was a voluntary plan. It had ambitious goals, but no real teeth to speak of, and the Clinton administration was a period of very anemic government action and continuing and significant growth in U.S. greenhouse gas emissions. Then came the Kyoto Protocol in 1997, and you may remember that then Vice President Gore made a very dramatic 11th hour intervention in Kyoto, which was very exciting, but he came back to the United States with a treaty that was pretty much dead on arrival. There was no appetite in the United States for adopting the Kyoto Protocol, and the Clinton administration never even really tried to get the protocol adopted here in the United States. And so we then came to the Bush administration, and the Bush administration initially wanted no part of the climate issue, but in many respects, its hand was forced. And as we move through the first decade of the new millennium, we saw certainly rising concern in the scientific community and rising alarm on the part of the population, or at least certain segments of the population, and a surprising desire on the part of the U.S. Senate to do something. We had the McCain-Lieberman legislation, which was introduced a couple of times and did not pass, but each time it was voted on by the Senate, it got more and more votes, and we had a coalition between the business community and the environmental community called U.S. CAMP, in which business leaders more or less accepted the science on climate change and the need for emission limits. And so with that backdrop, President Obama was elected, and it seemed to all of us, it certainly seemed to me, naive though I was, that the moment had finally arrived for all the forces to align, and we would make a major breakthrough on climate internationally and domestically. The reality is that, yes, for the first time in history, a branch of the U.S. Congress passed climate legislation, but it really didn't go anywhere and died a very inglorious death. And then President Obama went to Copenhagen later in 2009, where expectations were very, very high, that there might be a significant step forward internationally, but that really did not happen. The U.S. Did agree to a goal of reducing emissions by 17% below 2005 levels, but most people at the time thought that that was window dressing. It was more rhetorical than real. Now, while this history, this rather sad history, was playing itself out, in 2007, the Supreme Court decided Mass v. EPA, and this put the Clean Air Act and EPA squarely at the center of the climate policy debate, and it was a game-changing decision. I won't go into the details. They were discussed this morning, but suffice it to say, the court made it clear that EPA had authority under the Act to regulate greenhouse gas emissions. And not only that, I think it created a kind of presumption that EPA should be regulating greenhouse gas emissions and needed to regulate greenhouse gas emissions unless it can determine, based on the science, that those emissions were not endangering public health or welfare. What's interesting about this decision is I think it really could have gone the other way. I think that the arguments in the dissents are strong arguments legally, but the majority decided to take a very big step. And it's always a tricky business to try to read between the lines and figure out why the court did what it did. But I think when you read the majority opinion, it's pretty clear that the justices were troubled by the history of governmental inaction on climate change, and they were also quite aware of the emerging science, which is actually discussed at some length in the court's decision. And basically, they wanted to create an action-forcing mechanism that could overcome the inertia of Congress and the executive branch. So what happened during the first Obama term? EPA took fairly cautious steps to use the authority conferred by the Supreme Court, but the White House eyed us suspiciously from a distance. They didn't want to get too close to us, and they sent signals that, gee, don't go too far here, and so there was some hesitation, I think, on how far EPA felt it was at liberty to go. And as I think Jeff Homestead discussed this morning, the conventional wisdom, including, by the way, within the administration, was that it was all very well and good to threaten action under the Clean Air Act because that would bring industry to the table and would bring Republicans in Congress, but God forbid that you actually use the Clean Air Act. And of course, if you did, that would probably be a disaster because the Clean Air Act was never really meant to be used in this way. And I think Jeff Homestead this morning described some of the reasons why that view prevailed. But I think the president has really pivoted on that issue with his climate action plan, and In essence, I would argue that he has rejected the conventional wisdom. Part of that is political exigency. Now that he's been reelected, he doesn't face the same threats of political reprisal that he faced before. But I would also argue that there are some very important changes in the landscape that have occurred over the last couple of years that really created an opening for use of the Clean Air Act. First, although nobody should have been surprised by this, I think we are now at a point where everybody recognizes that Congress just isn't going to act. It just isn't going to happen. And so, therefore, the notion of using the Clean Air Act as a threat is meaningless now. Secondly, the many predictions that the Clean Air Act was a blunt instrument that could not really be applied to climate change, I think have proven to be unfounded, and that the initial steps that EPA took did not have the doomsday type of impacts that many people predicted. EPA, working with Department of Transportation, I think was very successful in moving the needle on greenhouse gas emissions from motor vehicles. And the tailoring rule, which Jeff said this morning is a kind of nothing burger, actually was very successful in narrowing the scope of permitting requirements, not overwhelming the system with thousands of permits from marginal emitting sources that would cause a breakdown in permitting at the national and state level. And the reality is not many permits have been submitted because of the success of the tailoring rule, and maybe Jeff is right that the permits have not accomplished a lot, but I think the important thing is that the flexibility to create a common sense practical permitting scheme was there in the Clean Air Act, and EPA seized it and made it work. The third factor is that we have seen extreme weather events. We have seen clear rises in sea levels. We have seen what, at least to me, is a fairly frightening melting of the polar ice cap, and the scientists, although they have been put to the test and in many cases attacked quite strenuously, the scientists, I think, have stuck by their guns. And so there is now, I think, a more compelling case to act. The final factor that I want to mention here that I think is very, very important is that the U.S. energy system has changed a great deal in the last 6 years. And this has created opportunities for emission reduction that few would have predicted. And the first of these changes is of course, plentiful and cheap natural gas, which has undercut our historical reliance on coal and begun to shift the fuel mix rather significantly. The other thing that has happened is renewables, wind and solar, have really taken root more in some parts of the country than in others. But if you look at the new generation that's been built over the last several years, renewables have represent a significant share of that. Energy efficiency has also continued to improve, and the result of that, which I think Bob Percival mentioned this morning, is that actually U.S. greenhouse gas emissions are going down. And just take a moment to reflect on the significance of that, because it really does represent a reversal of 100 years of emissions increases as our economy expanded. And so now something very new is happening. And in the power plant sector, the prediction of the Energy Information Agency is that even without any government regulation under the Clean Air Act, we can expect that by 2020, power plant emissions are going to be 13% lower than they were in 2005, which is really outstanding. And I think it suggests that there are now forces at work that are transforming our energy system, and that which policymakers can build on in achieving the next increment of environmental protection. So let me now turn to some of the challenges that EPA faces under the Clean Air Act. I think the big challenge, which was alluded to this morning, is that the classic paradigm of bolt-on emission control technology, which we certainly use to address conventional pollutants, doesn't work very effectively for greenhouse gases. What does work effectively are the types of changes in our energy system that I was just describing, and the big question that the panel addressed is whether there is the flexibility of the Act to move beyond the end-of-pipe pollution control paradigm to more of a system-type approach. Just briefly, I'll mention the interrelationship between the new and existing source standards. The new source standards are the predicate for regulation of existing sources, and I think that the big gold mine here is with existing sources and not new sources at this point in time, particularly since no new coal plants are being built in the United States. So I think the best way to view the new source standard is as a symbolic statement. Having said that, I think it's a very important symbolic statement. And one reason why it's an important symbolic statement is that it puts gas plants and coal plants on the same footing. That is to say, it sets an emission performance bar for both types of plants, which is roughly equivalent. And the message there, I believe, is that is a broad policy message, which is to compete and be a viable part of the energy mix going forward. We should expect that coal plants be in the ballpark of other types of generation from a greenhouse gas standpoint. And my personal view is that if that's not the case and we continue to build coal plants that have significantly higher emissions, the world is just not going to be very successful in reducing emissions. The linchpin of the proposal here is carbon capture and storage. We heard Jeff express a lot of skepticism this morning about whether CCS really is mature enough to provide a basis for an NSPS that can be sustained legally. I disagree with Jeff on that. I actually think that EPA did a very good job of making a record that will be difficult to attack. I want to go on to the existing source standards because that's where the action is, and that's where the real emission reduction is going to come from if there is emission reduction. And I want to start with the point that for clean air aficionados, this process is very much like the state implementation plan process, which is to say that EPA sets a goal, and then it's up to the states to decide what tools they're going to use to achieve that goal. And so there are, I think, two very critical questions here. Number one, what emission reduction target can EPA set as a minimum level of state performance? In other words, EPA perhaps can't tell the states exactly what to do, but it can give them a target to work towards, and that target can be a minimum target. And so the question is, what should that target be, and how should EPA determine what that target should be? And then the second question is, once that target is established, what are the compliance tools that are available to the states in meeting it? So the key to this issue, which was also discussed this morning, is the concept in the statute of best system of emission reduction that is adequately demonstrated, or BS. ER. And the battle lines are forming over this issue. And in fact, they were reflected in the first panel this morning. And the choice, I think, is a rather simple and a rather stark one. Under the narrow interpretation, the focus would be within the fence line. That is to say, within the four corners of the facility, what improvements and equipment or plant operation can be made that will reduce emissions. And under the broader approach, the the focus would be on the interlocking elements of the energy system, both within and in outside the facility. And I would point out that the term in the statute is best system of emission reduction. It doesn't say best control technology. It talks about a system of emission reduction, and a system of emission reduction can involve many, many different things. And what we know for electric utilities is that the actual emissions are a function of the fuel that they burn, a function of electricity demand, because demand is lower, they're going to be lower emissions. It's a function of the way in which different plants are dispatched to the grid and in different circumstances. And all of those elements work together to determine what emissions are. And so you can view them as the part of a system of emission reduction. So I come to a very important point, again, that was touched on this morning. If you go with the narrow approach, then the consequence of that is you're probably going to focus on investments in facility efficiency that basically lower the heat rate, and by doing that, lower emissions. And there's perhaps some difference of opinion on how far that can get you. I personally think that it's in the range of 2 to 3% at best, but there's no disagreement that it's not going to get you very far. If you take the broader approach, then looking at the entire system, I think it's well within reach to achieve a reduction on the order of 10 to 12%, which would be significant. And I would echo the point that was made this morning. Why go through all this mishigas only to achieve a 2% reduction on top of a 13% reduction that the utility sector has already achieved? So to me, the logic is fairly compelling. You know, you have to go long here. You got to think big. I think that a very difficult issue, even if you go with the systems approach, is how do you define performance targets for the states? And there are a number of different ways of doing that. You could set average emission rate targets for coal and natural gas plants, and then the goal that each state would have to meet would basically be a function of the relative number of coal and gas plants in their generation mix. Or you could take a kind of mass-based approach where you define a national performance target. Let's say it's a 10% reduction, and then you say to all of the states, you guys, each of you are responsible for a 10% reduction, and we're not going to say some states have to do more and some states have to do less. This is a very, I think, a very potent issue, because if there is a lack of perceived equity between the states, it is going to be, I think, a huge problem for EPA. Then, turning to the scope of state flexibility, I think actually there's quite a lot that states could do. And if you start from the premise that it's up to them, as it is in the SIP process, to decide how they're going to meet the national goal. There are a wide variety of tools that are available, and I think the only real constraint is that those tools need to have a nexus with power plant greenhouse gas reductions. In other words, you can't encourage ride sharing in San Francisco, which removes cars from the road, and say, aha, those reductions can be used to meet what is in essence a power plant standard. But I think if you can show the nexus, then pretty much anything is on the table here. So let me come to a very critical issue, which is, will the states and the utilities play ball? And to me, even leaving apart all the legal questions that we talked about this morning, this is the fundamental heart of the matter politically, because if a critical mass of states say we don't want any part of this, if EPA wants to send in the jackbooted Gestapo to enforce greenhouse gas standards in our state, they can do that. It will be over our dead bodies, but we're not going to lift a finger to help these guys. And I think that there are certainly a number of states who are going to say that. Conversely, there are a dozen or so states that I think are going to be very supportive, and they're basically the Northeast states that are participating in the REGI program, and the West Coast states, California, Washington, and Oregon. And then there are going to be a whole bunch of states in the middle who won't be quite sure what to do here. And they're really going to be torn between, on the one hand, fighting EPA to the bitter end, and on the other, getting into the mix and working with EPA to devise something that advantages them should they have to implement a standard. And I think it may be a temptation for EPA to say we're going to work with the states that like us, and we're not going to horse around with the states who don't. But I think that would be a huge political mistake. And EPA's got to find a way to engage these states that are in the middle. And I think it needs to be sensitive to the needs of states that do have a large amount of coal generation. And I'm not sure I know exactly what that means at this point, but for example, to say that all California needs to do is continue down the road of implementing AB 32, and that's going to be just great, but the state of Ohio has got to achieve a 25% emission reduction because of all their coal plants. That is not going to play very well. And so there needs to be some burden sharing here that people will accept as equitable. There are some of the same issues with the utilities. I think the utilities are going to follow the leads of their states. And so, you know, you would expect the Southern California Edisons and Pacific Gas and Electric to be supportive of EPA, expect the New England utilities to be supportive, but the real action is going to be with the large utility systems the South and the Middle West. And I see those guys as being on the fence because they have already closed a lot of coal plants, and so protecting coal is not necessarily a sacred trust for them. But having said that, they've been spending a lot of money on complying with the MATS rule. They don't have mature, in many of these states, renewable programs or energy efficiency programs. So they're going to be worried about going too far, too fast. And again, EPA's got to create a dynamic where there is at least dialogue with those utilities and with their states. The final point I wanted to make very briefly is the clock is working against EPA here. And the schedule the president has set is really a very tough schedule. I think EPA can probably get the rulemaking done by the end of the administration, but as Jeff Homestead correctly pointed out, I don't think that the state implementation phase can be completed by the end of the administration without a great deal of chaos and disruption and a kind of forced march, which I don't think is going to work in the end. So I see that phase of it carrying over into the next administration, and obviously the upcoming presidential election will have an influence on how that goes. So the final point is, will EPA aim high, or will EPA try to grind it out here one or two yards at a time? And I honestly think that right now EPA is the only game in town on climate, and we have a president who has said that climate is a legacy issue for him. And, you know, if I were EPA, if I were the White House, I would say, go for broke here. Why do all of this if it isn't going to amount to anything? So I think that even though there will be very difficult moments and the slings and arrows will become very intense here, I think that EPA will aim high.